Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
I think, you know, culture is, you know, part of the ingredient. To me, it's got to be, you got to love what the company does. You got to believe in the mission of the company. And if there's a great culture that you feel comfortable within, that you feel respects who you are, that allows you to have positive and constructive relationships that you feel comfortable in, that you feel safe in, and hopefully, you know, that culture has a lot of diversity and inclusion as part of it, so that you get a lot more broad perspectives to help you create better products for customers, I think that can be a great combination.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamin Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. Today, my guest is Mark Zionst, CEO of Automated Insights. Automated Insights is the creator of Wordsmith, the world's first public natural language generation platform. Wordsmith allows users to generate human-sounding narratives from data. Prior to Automated Insights, Mark has been a leader in both technology and market research firms for over two decades. Mark, thanks very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here.
So talk to us a little bit about your early days, about your parents and where you're raised and how that has impacted your career.
Well, thank you. So I'm very fortunate that my parents were both working throughout my entire life as I was growing up. And I was born up north, and then we moved down to Florida when I was young. But my parents, my mother's an educator, and my father always worked in the electronics industry. And a couple of kind of standouts from there that I really, you know, were great inspirations for me. First of all, my mother as an educator just really focused on the importance of being a lifelong learner and to be a reader. And she set a great example by doing a couple things. One, going back kind of mid-age and getting an advanced degree. And I think that's very admirable. And at the same time, you know, once my parents got older, they had not traveled a lot. And by the time they were 50, I think they just traveled maybe to two countries. But since then, they've traveled to 125 countries. So I think, you know, the whole quest for knowledge, understanding, and learning is something that my mother as an educator certainly imparted upon me. On my father's side, always had good careers, but I have to honestly say my father really never enjoyed working. So that actually set another very good example for me, and that is life is short, you better love what you do, you better be passionate about what you do, and if you are fortunate enough to have those things occur, you know, as they say, work doesn't become work. It becomes a part of your life. It becomes something where you become hungry for knowledge. You're continuously interested in getting better, improving, and learning more. So in different ways, you know, my parents had impacts on me, but certainly I think it was foundational for me in terms of developing.
Yeah, I found that as I enjoy what I'm doing for a living, it creates this beautiful bleed into every other area of my life. And so it actually winds up, work can be an enhancer of my relationships because, you know, it isn't just a stop and start experience. And when I get home, I don't have to plop down on the couch and have a beer or think I'd have to do that anyway, right? It's, you can engage and then, you know, there's not like this, I've got to go to work right now mentality. It's more of a get to experience.
By all means.
The point about your mom and dad traveling, going from only two to 125 countries is really interesting. Have you done a significant amount of travel as well?
I have. I've probably been to more countries than that. And then my wife is a traveler and our four adult children, that was kind of something they were exposed to from their earliest days, is always being on a plane and going everywhere and around the world. And subsequently, they have a passion as well. A number of them have spent time abroad with their college or in between college, running overseas, spending extended periods of times, months abroad. So our children, I think, have a passion for it. And, you know, you're privileged to have that. But the way you pay that back, I think, is in terms of your understanding of the world, your understanding of you know, and as it relates to our business, you know, as you know, be it technology, whatever perspectives you have, I think you have a much broader and a more balanced view. And hopefully that can help you contribute back, you know, to whatever field you're in, and help you relate to others. And hopefully there's goodness in all that, because I realize that's not something that everybody gets to do. In fact, you know, that so you need to take it, you know, to be respectful of being fortunate for that, but at the same time, you know, hopefully get something back and be able to contribute back as a result.
Yeah, a lot of times people think that it's only for the rich and famous, that sort of, you know, going overseas once every few years. But the reality is you can do it fairly inexpensively even today. You've got to be very mindful, obviously, about planning things out and controlling your costs and, you know, where you stay, et cetera, but it is feasible to get overseas. And the people that I've interacted with that have decided not to travel, it seems like their biggest barrier is just this fear of unknown, as opposed to it being a financial constraint. Of course, you're 100% correct that we're very fortunate to be able to travel, and I'm not trying to impose that we're not, but the fact is that, you know, it really does provide a ton of value for you as an individual, and obviously your family as well, in the event that you can expose yourself to other cultures, other cuisines. Just, you know, that really opens your worldview, and I think provides you a fuller idea of what it is to be human and where we should be focusing.
I absolutely agree with you.
So in the context of your background, because you have quite a storied career, maybe you could talk to us a little bit about one of the biggest challenges that you faced.
Yeah, so I think what's really interesting is as I look back and I frankly look forward, is I've always worked in technology, but I've been very careful to not define myself too narrowly. And I think that's really important, because I think you have to focus in on what is it that you're, you know, trying to do? What is it you're trying to accomplish? If you dig your heels in, and for example, you say, I'm a C++ programmer, your career will be limited. You know, the issue should be more, you know, about, you know, I create, you know, I'm excellent, world-class at UI UX design. And by the way, the tools I use may change, but I'm not married to a language or something very narrow. So in my world, I mean, you know, if you look back at technology 30 years ago, a lot of what we were doing was in the world of hardware. Well, today, to a large extent, hardware, storage, bandwidth have all become more ubiquitous and accessible to businesses. So there's a lot more, I think, innovation and development around the world of software and software as a service. So I feel like I've moved from, you know, hardware to proprietary software to open software to software as a service. And it's really been kind of a journey. So I think, you know, I would summarize that as you better be able to deal with change, and you better be agile, and you also need to be a learning individual. I am so excited about what we do as a company. I'm so excited about technology. And I've been doing this since high school, you know, so since the 70s, I've been involved in tech. And I feel like we're scratching the surface of what's possible. I continually have moved my career from one innovative area to another innovative area. So it's fresh. I'm learning. I'm working with other people that are maybe earlier in their careers, and they have a lot to teach me about their technologies or how they solve problems. So I guess my big summaries would be, if you're not comfortable with change, I think the business world, whether it's technology or anything else, is going to be very cruel to you. And if you want to be relevant currently and in the future, you better be a learning individual.
So humble, open to change. When I was reviewing your bio, you actually have a snippet on LinkedIn talking about your cycling passion. Specifically, cyclocross stood out.
Yes.
competitiveness is a major part of that in any cycling sport. I've done cycling on and off for about 20 years, and it's such a love-hate relationship. well, it's all love, I should say, but it can be a bittersweet sometimes when, anyway, so performances aren't up to snuff. Do you feel like your competitive nature is expressed in business in the way that you have to be humble? In other words, you can't just assume you're going to win, and you have to be adaptable because the world is changing?
Yeah, so I believe that there's a tremendous amount of analogies between sports in business, or even more broadly, sports in life. One, as you mentioned, is kind of humility. I mean, you may think you're great and you may be great compared to the general population, but when you get with a bunch of people like you, all of a sudden it's like very humbling and very hard when you're competing. So, you know, that's a valuable lesson, because I think you'll encounter that, be it in life, be that in business, that, you know, you may be very smart, but when you're around a lot of other smart people, you know, how do you stand out? How do you differentiate? The other thing, so I think with sports, is that sports just really, it's all about, you know, setting goals. Are you goal oriented? Are you disciplined to train, to do the hard work necessary? I mean, the hard work isn't the race. The hard work is everything that leads up to the race. If you've done your homework, you're going to have a good race, just like in business. And so, you know, when I see people that have an outside passion, and you know, it can be competitive or non-competitive, you know, I think that's a great kind of characteristic about somebody from a work perspective, because I think it translates into their work. They want to continuously improve. They want to set goals and accomplish goals. They want to be the best that they can be. They have passion in their life. It may also imply that you have some balance. I mean, you've got to take care of yourself and feel good about yourself. You've got to take care of your family or your partners or your friends and feel good about that. If those things are in order, work's pretty good. If those things aren't in order, maybe work's good for a little bit of time, but that's when you hear about the burnout, or that's when you hear about the person that just says, you know, I'm a workaholic and I'm unhappy. Well, of course you are, because you didn't have any balance in your life and you weren't taking care of the things that are really important. You know, yourself, your friends, your family. I mean, those are the things that matter. So when I find somebody that has an outside passion, be it sports or something else, I know that they're disciplined because they're trying to work and get their work done and excel and can improve. But at the same time, they have a life. So, you know, it brings some balance to the whole equation.
Yeah, totally. My most productive years are always when I am maintaining a level of balance, or specifically relative to, you know, family and also cycling or triathlons or CrossFit or whatever it is that's, you know, hitting me at that particular point. The thing that I think you're right, that protects us from burnout is when we are, I'll call it balanced, and I put that in quotation, air quotes, by the way, we are oftentimes working a lot. So there's a lot of hours that are still happening. It's just our view of that work is much more in line with an enjoyment, as opposed to that humdrum have to sort of framing. The thing that I want to pull out a little bit more on, though, is what you said about the preparation for the competition. It really isn't the case that you know, businesses or a competition is won at that particular event. I mean, it is, but you know, you might know that you can get to the top three based on the actual work that you put in to that effort, right, or to that event. And I think that analogy, carrying it out a little bit, is exactly relevant for all of us. Is, you know, the scariest times for me in business is when everything is going great, and then I wind up taking my foot off the gas pedal and resting on my laurels a little bit. Have you had experiences like that, or seen that happen to other companies?
Without a doubt. So that kind of brings up another kind of a characteristic that you look for in people, which is often reflected in competitive people as well, and that is resiliency. I mean, It's, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, if everything's going well, you need to be humble, because I guarantee you it won't continue forever and things will go downhill, you know, at some point, and you have to deal with that. And on the flip side of that, you need to be resilient and determined, because when things are at rock bottom at the other end of the cycle, you should take some solace in knowing that it's not going to stay there forever and it will get better. So, you know, you kind of got the, you know, if you have a wave of the top and the bottom, it's going to be some sort of a wave of sort, a sine wave, you know, where you're going to, when you're at the top, you know where it's going next. And when you're at the bottom, you know where it will go next. It's important to keep that in mind.
It feeds your whole, the whole journey thing, right? Which is exactly what you're describing. I love that. I love that vision or that picture. You came into this space, this company, Automated Insights, really from the outside, after it had already been launched. What was the initial focus of Automated Insights?
Yeah, so, you know, the company was well underway when I joined. In terms of the focus, you know, the company in its earlier days was very much about innovation and product, as it should be in a young company. I came in and was brought in by our private equity owner to take the company really to a next level, to work on scaling it up and building it up and adding in, if you will, the commercial emphasis to the business. The challenge is I love what we do from a product perspective. I have nothing but admiration for our founder and for the founding team around innovation and product. And I didn't want to take any, you know, spotlight off of that. But I wanted to equal weight that with a commercial business around sales and partnerships and business development and channels and marketing. And so that was the challenge, is preserve the initial focus around product and innovation and retain those chops, if you will, while adding in the other components, which to me simply validates that, yep, we've got great product. You know, if we're the leader, if our business is growing, if customers are benefiting from our solution, that's a complete validation of everything the product team is doing. So for me, it was really that focus of, you know, transitioning culture to equal weight the commercial sides in the same way we had initially done around product and innovation.
The point that you're making here is really important. And I think a lot of founders forget about that. And that is that a business is fundamental. But the reason that it's a business is that it's making money. And it is easy to get caught up in the actual product. But the point is that, you know, there's a much broader play, and that is the overall organization and the investment in the organism. You know, that it needs to be complete, and not just with a head. You need the ability to move around and grab things and that sort of thing. And that infrastructure is vital based on, you know, different, well, actually throughout the life cycle of any business. And it's good to hear that that institutionalization is a big part of what you guys are doing. And obviously, as you said, equal partner with the product in moving the market in the right direction and bringing value. Can you talk to us a little bit specifically about what Automated Insights is and the value it's bringing to the market?
So natural language generation is or NLG, as we refer to it, is taking in structured data and writing stories, reports, or narratives in software that sound like they were created by a person. So there's many business use cases for this, and we work in two major realms. One, where we take in data and we create this directly, or two, where we integrate with business intelligence software. Products like Tableau or Click or MicroStrategy or TIBCO or Power BI. The use case around BI is that, according to Gartner, 2/3 of the people in an enterprise, when they look at a dashboard or visualization, they think it's very interesting, but they have one fundamental question. And that question is, what does that mean? So they don't actually process, if you will, the meaning that was intended by the analyst, the business analyst that created that dashboard. So as a result, what companies end up doing is they might screenshot or export a dashboard, and then an analyst writes up bullets, narrative by hand saying what it means. Or worse yet, somebody thinks they know what it means, they misinterpret the data, and they make a business decision based on their misunderstanding of the data. And that's very expensive. Or even a third scenario, we see people go into a meeting that's an hour long, and they spend 50 minutes of the meeting debating what the data means. And they only reserve the last 10 minutes of the meeting to discuss what they're going to do about it. And all three of these cases are not productive. So when you can add in narrative to dashboards that fully interacts with the dashboard as you're clicking around and looking at different scenarios, and there's narrative there to explain to you what it means, that becomes incredibly valuable to an enterprise. It's also great for the BI software because it means more people in the enterprise can use BI software. So it expands the total available market for the BI software provider. So our BI partners benefit, we benefit, and most importantly, the customer benefits. So that's one big set of use cases. Our other use cases is where we just take in structured data, and from structured data, we can create these narratives, reports, and stories. And there's a good chance that you've seen our work and not necessarily realized it's us. For example, we are quite visible in the world of journalism. There are lots of stories that are data-driven stories. A data-driven story could be a financial story, a sports story, a weather story, anything that has really data at the core. As an example, the Associated Press writes and sells stories on all public companies 4 times a year when they announce their quarterly earnings. All of those stories are being written by our software, not by a business journalist. Likewise, the Associated Press sells stories on all 16,000 minor league baseball games. Once again, that's being written by our software. Or many people like to play fantasy football, be it with Yahoo, be it with the National Football League. And part of that experience is getting a weekly recap telling you how your fantasy team is doing. It's a totally customized story about you and your team. And once a week, you get a recap that tries to keep you engaged in the season and frankly tries to draw you back into those software platforms so that you spend more time trying to improve your team as the season goes on. And why do they care about that? Well, they make their money with ad revenue monetization. So if you're more engaged, they can make more money. So all those narratives are created by our software as well. So if you think about an NFL football season, you could be talking about over 100 million individualized stories a season that are being written through our software. So there's many places that people can see us: Dow Jones Group, The Economist, Standard & Poor's, you know, many very visible places where our software is being used to write stories that are personalized or at scale or based on somebody's role. But all of these are cases where we're using data to create narrative, reports, stories, and help people understand what the data means or engage them with the data.
Story is the number one gap that has come up in the conversations I've had with large brands. The block and tackling of getting the data in a presentable format just doesn't seem to be the issue. And there's a million different ways and tools that they're using and vendors, partners to get those consumer insights. But, you know, the magic it for them is that last bit, in the red zone, when the delivery is happening to the executives. You know, the more powerful the story, the more powerful it connects with that executive, and then the bigger lever it has in moving the decision process throughout the whole organization. Are you seeing market research data as well as you said, journalism playing out with using your tools?
Many people use take survey data, which is, again, a data story, and to create that into a narrative report that people can understand, they're using our software. So we see it in the area of market research, market surveys, voting information. We have a lot of customers in the CPG space, you know, brands, where they're doing constant reporting around attribution, around shared data, around competitive data. It is very common for them to be using that information as the data input to create the narrative, or if they're looking at that in business intelligence, to add the narrative in so more people correctly understand what that information means. So yes, certainly a great area for us because there's good data available.
The, you know, voice is on the rise. The way that we're consuming information is moving from written word, not like, you know, not, it's never going to go to zero. It's going to be a huge part of our consumption, but, you know, there's more and more audio being consumed through podcasts like this one or audiobooks or what have you. Are you guys looking into that space as well as a distribution area?
We're already there. When we think about publishing the output of our narrative, our API puts out what's called a JSON file. It's a JavaScript object. That allows you to publish the output as an email, as a text, in HTML, in your application, in a game console, or right to a device like Alexa or Google Home. We have customers in the world of gaming, in the world of weather, where you're simply asking Google Home or you're asking Alexa about the weather or about the weather for an activity. You know, what should I wear today to go golf? Or you're asking about, if you just YouTube Alexa Call of Duty, you'll see an example of our software because they show YouTubes of how that works now, where you're asking Alexa about how you're doing in Call of Duty and it tells you your story.
That's super interesting. So from the JSON file, you're able to generate really any sort of output natively to the specific platform.
That's right. So we basically data in, runs through their software in the cloud. The data is not retained, so there's no privacy issues. JSON back out, published to any platform.
What are you seeing as a macro trend inside of the market research space right now?
I think it's actually, I can answer this more broadly than just the market research space. And I just think it's very simple. People are overwhelmed by the amount of data that is now being created and being able to try to process that and understand that is becoming a challenge that is, you know, surpassing people's ability to consume it. So we get right back to what people really want is to understand the data. They don't necessarily need the data to view the data. In fact, our vision statement as a company is we make the world's data understandable. I say it, you know, the way I like to, you know, take people on this, you know, this discovery, if you will, is I say, just go back in time, go into a cave and look on the wall. There's not a spreadsheet. There's not a chart. There's not a dashboard. There's not a visualization. There's a story there. Somebody's trying to tell you a story about what something means. And I think that's what people just need is that they don't have 15 minutes, 20 minutes to play around with the data. They just want to know what are the three key drivers that I need to be focused on? What are my KPI? Just tell me about my KPIs that are more than plus or minus 3% out of range. You know, show me some, you know, are there any anomalies that I should be aware of? You know, and, you know, people are looking for that to be fed to them because of the amount of data they have to deal with in making business decisions and the constraints on their time to make those accurate and actionable decisions.
This next question, I think, is probably one of the more important questions that we're going to wind up covering today. And that is, a large portion of our audience are executives inside of the market research world specifically, and you come into this space with a tremendous amount of relevant experience. What is one piece of advice or secret that you leverage to achieve success for shareholders and the company?
So I think what's vital here is, you know, defining the problem that you're trying to solve, you know, or the value proposition you're trying to offer. So the definition of what that is, you know, the problem statement, and then what is that corresponding value proposition you have to address that problem statement. Now, the magic is this a niche issue? Or is this a mainstream issue? And I think that will, you know, drive a lot of success factors in your business. I guess, for example, I mean, if you're talking about the whole world of data analytics, you have market research, you have survey data, you want to get to the bottom of what does that mean? It means that capabilities like ours probably need to be incorporated in every solution over the next few years. So, you know, how are you going to get there? Are you going to work with somebody like us? Are you going to want to OEM us and build us into your product so you can add that capability for your clients directly? Are you going to try to build it yourself? I think people are going to wrestle with these solutions as it relates to what we do. But as it relates to the space in general, I think, you know, the most fundamental issue is, you know, that original definition. We see the problem as this. Our solution will address the problem by doing these things. So I think, you know, that to me is fundamental, because look, you can create the coolest thing in the world, and if there just isn't a big enough problem out there, it's going to be really interesting. It's not going to be super relevant. Maybe you'll have a little niche product, but you're not going to have something that goes mainstream and creates a tremendous amount of value.
What do you see as the three characteristics of an all-star employee, not just at Automate, but Automated Insights, but more broadly, you know, given your depth of career?
Three things that I would name right away would be passion, agility, and accountability. So, you know, first, and I touched on this earlier in our discussion, you got to love what you do. You know, so, I mean, if you don't, it's a job. If you don't, you'll be there for a period of time. But they think at the end of the day, you really have to love what it is you're doing. And by the way, that can extend to who you're working with, who you're working for, what is the culture. But I think the most basic building block of that aspect is, do you believe in the product? Do you believe in what the company does? Do you believe in the mission? I think people in our company get pretty excited about the fact that we help people understand their data. And they see that as a huge problem, and they see that as something creating value. So I think our people have passion around that, because they think it's a big challenge, and it creates a tremendous amount of value. So that passion, I think, is just vital. The second one I mentioned was agility. And I spoke on this earlier. You know, if you don't like change, if you don't like having to zig instead of zag sometimes, if you think everything is going to go on your perfectly on your 3 to 5 year plan, good luck. That's not my experience. I'm always suspect when somebody tells me, this is my plan from the beginning, we did it perfectly, and this was our outcome. And I just smile and I'm polite. Because when I look back on everything, many times we ended up in great places, but it certainly wasn't a smooth road. There were bumps along the way. And then finally, accountability. I think it's accountability to yourself, accountability to your colleagues, accountability to your customers. And I think if you have people that are accountable, it also affords you great freedom. It's freedom for people to, you know, work remotely when they want to work remotely, or be working, you know, if they have something in the middle of the day with their kids and they're going to, you know, get their deliverable out that evening, it enables that to happen. You know, so, you know, you can have a trust-based organization when people are accountable. I mean, I think in our company, we're an example, and I think many companies do these days. You know, we have unlimited vacation. And, you know, the interesting thing that happens is that if you look across companies in America and you say, what's the average, you know, in a white-collar job, what is the average amount of vacation people are allotted between, you know, their various tenures? It works out to be 3 weeks. We give unlimited vacation. So what do you think the average person in our company ends up taking?
I'm going to go with 3 weeks.
Bingo. But we didn't have to, you know, we don't have a documentation system. We don't have a traditional hierarchy. We don't have to, you know, apply for vacation. We have accountable people. So you trust them and they deliver and you end up with the same result, but it's based on accountability. It's based on trust. So, you know, to me, these are three key things in recruiting: passion, you know, agility, accountability. Now, these are characteristics. Before we even get there, you know, we are big on, you know, being very selective in hiring. And I think this is also something people need to consider. Look, when you have a software company, you know, you don't have a factory, you don't have a warehouse, you don't have a distribution network. You write code. You better have the best people you can. And if you want to satisfy customers, you need the best people. So our front end of the process, the way we evaluate, the way we test people, it is extensive, it is selective, but we think it produces really excellent results.
What is the role of culture inside of the organizations that you've managed? And has it evolved over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. Culture is not a static thing. It's a living, breathing thing. I think culture is often set and influenced heavily by the CEO and the senior team. But it's also a function of the people within the company. And it's at the stage of the company. You know, so, you know, for example, you can say, you know, our culture is to work hard. But if your CEO doesn't work hard, that, you know, that may not be part of it. But, you know, we try to have one where, you know, part of our culture, if you will, and things that are core to our values are enjoying the journey, you know, enjoying what you do, you know, and we try to set that example. I mean, if you don't have fun and levity and enjoy who you work with, again, life's going to be a bit tough. One of our, you know, values is no jerks in the business. That doesn't mean, you know, everybody's chums with each other, but they should respect each other. And you don't want disrespectful people because that's not healthy in the organization. So I think culture is really important. I think culture, though, is also a product of the, you know, the passion that you have for the problem that you're solving. You know, so you can't necessarily go to a company where you say, oh, you know, that's the coolest company in the world because, you know, they have off every Friday and Thursday afternoons, they have barbecues and, you know, you know, they have a sliding board between the first and second floor. That's part of their fun culture. Well, that's interesting, but if they don't do something relevant, that probably doesn't last for too long. It may get you in the door. It doesn't keep you in the door. So I think, you know, culture is, you know, part of the ingredient. To me, it's got to be, you got to love what the company does. You got to believe in the mission of the company. And if there's a great culture that you feel comfortable within, that you feel respects who you are, that allows you to have positive and constructive relationships that you feel comfortable in, that you feel safe in, and hopefully, you know, that culture has a lot of diversity and inclusion as part of it so that you get a lot more broad perspectives to help you create better products for customers. I think that can be a great combination. But you can't, I don't think you can isolate it as one variable and say, you know, people are here just because of the culture. Well, you know, I hope it's as part of that whole mission of the company as well.
So I have a personal question for you. Are you still cycling?
Absolutely. I commute to work I either do one of two things. I Uber to the airport or I bike to and from work during the weekdays. And on the weekends, I'm either racing or I'm out riding 4 to 5 hours a day.
Okay. If I'm not racing. That's awesome. So you kind of answered my question there. One of the challenges for me in cycling has been actually having dedicated cycling time, just because it tends to take a little bit longer than other sports. How do you manage it when you travel? Because I know you have an extensive travel schedule.
So when I'm traveling, unless I'm going someplace for a week, I'm not going to typically rent a bike or bring a bike. I mean, maybe it doesn't have to be a week. It could be 3 or 4 days, but usually my schedules aren't like that. So I'm working out on the road. So I'm doing cross training. I'm in the gym. I'm out running. I'm doing other things, but I never miss a day of working out.
My guest today has been Mark Zients, CEO of Automated Insights. Mark, thanks very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone who's been listening. Please take time to subscribe, provide us some feedback. This helps us grow our audience and allows other insight professionals to find this podcast. Have a great day, everybody. Shelley Bourne, research manager at Detroit Pistons. She's dropping next week. I really hope you tune in to this episode. It has a ton of value talking about how a research manager is using KPIs to communicate across the organization, ways for improvement, better customer outcomes. Tune in.